I want to thank my sponsors, or the sponsors for this talk, Dan Johnson and Randy Laskowitz. We thank you very much for your generous support. My discussion is coming out of my research on economic prosperity, and it's entitled Government Versus Prosperity in the Less Developed Countries. This is, in some sense, an age-old, decades-old, almost century-old issue now. And the good news is the first part of my talk was basically already given by Per Bylund, so we can go very quickly about that through this. Economic progress, economic prosperity is the result of a process of dynamic efficiency. I call it the happy consequence of a highly developed division of labor, taking advantage of an increasing capital stock that embodies the most economically productive technology and wisely invested by entrepreneurs. Dynamic efficiency is a concept that has been around for a while. It's been popularized most recently by Jesus Huerta de Soto and his work, and I think it's an apt description of the process that by which we get economic prosperity. So for prosperity, we need a flourishing division of labor, a specialization of production according to efficiency. We need savers and investors in capital accumulation so that producers have the capital goods available to produce and increase our productivity. We benefit from technological advance, so capital goods that are at a higher level of productivity and production processes that are more productive than those before. And that technological advance is always embodied in physical capital goods. Technology doesn't sort of just exist out there. I mean, the knowledge exists out there, but for the technology to be operational, it has to actually be embodied in physical capital goods. Again, one of the things that Per just emphasized is that the driver of this is the entrepreneur. The entrepreneur is the one who directs and sort of coordinates the division of labor and capital investment toward productive services most highly valued by people in society. Entrepreneur is motivated by profit. He has an incentive, therefore, to continually improve efficiency of production and continually improve the quality of products and continually look for new products that don't exist before and don't exist yet for this person or for the consumers to be able to benefit from things that they don't even realize that they could benefit from. Now, investment in capital goods tend to be in those capital goods that are more technically advanced over time. So as old capital goods wear out, the entrepreneurs have an incentive to find affordable capital goods of better technology to improve the efficiency of production even more, lowering costs even more, allowing people to enjoy even more goods at lower prices. Very importantly, it's only in a free market that entrepreneurs have the profit incentive to engage in this activity, and only in a free market do they have the ability to engage in economic calculation, because only in a free market do we have free market prices that are manifestations of people's subjective values that are all enumerated in the same unit, the monetary unit. And so when the entrepreneur compares the price of the product to the sum of the price of the factors of production, they can make meaningful objective calculations and compare different investment opportunities to find out which is more profitable. And when they do so, and they actually reap a profit, they reap a profit for doing precisely what people in society want them to do, which is provide the goods that they value the most in the least costly manner. Another important sort of fact of the economic prosperity process is that none of this is autonomous. None of these vehicles of prosperity are autonomous. It's a process of a dynamic efficiency. A highly developed division of labor, for instance, would be impossible without the accumulation and use of capital goods. The entrepreneur must invest real capital goods in the production process and direct them in the production process. The entrepreneur must be an actual owner of capital. To be useful in production, technology must be embodied in capital goods, as I mentioned already. And so capital accumulation and entrepreneurship are essential for economic progress to take place. So how do we have this happen? How do we make it happen? Well, We can sort of envision what could happen without the state, as we did at the end of Per's lecture with that beautiful visual of what might be or what could have been in this alternative dimension. Or we could, say, use the Santa Claus principle, right? We could try to fix things with the state. And so we could have central planning. And this is the path that has been taken by many less developed countries and moderately developed countries over the years. We could seek to achieve economic progress not by allowing free entrepreneurs to do the work, but by having central planners try to direct the entire ball of wax. In other words, we could take the socialist path. Now, socialism, the defining characteristic of socialism is a system in which there is government ownership of the means of production. So government owns or effectively controls the use of all land, labor, and capital goods. And we could call this the Santa Claus principle, because the states are going to provide this wonderful benefit. When we see here, right, this poster, this Soviet poster, and the caption there says, "Fight for the maximal use of all resources of collective production for a good harvest," right? The good harvest isn't going to happen because we're happily producing. We've got to fight for it, right? And there's an open hand, right? We have an open hand providing grain for all, made possible by the expropriator in chief, of course. Now, what's the type of economy in which this is expected to happen? Well, it's a socialist economy where, because all factors of production are owned by the state, there is no voluntary exchange for land, labor, and capital goods. And so no machines are traded voluntarily, no labor is traded voluntarily, no land is rented or sold voluntarily, and therefore there are no real prices for factors of production. No prices of land, no prices of labor, no market wage rates, no prices for capital goods. And therefore, economic decision makers cannot calculate profit and loss. They have no way to make meaningful comparisons about the expected selling price of the product and the expected the sum of the costs of the factors of production. And so, instead of a prosperous socialist economy, the exact opposite is the case. Socialism does not breed prosperity. Socialism breeds cultural declension, barbarism, poverty, and death. These two photos tell the story. This photo on the left is not a photo from a Nazi concentration camp. That is a photo of citizens in the Soviet Union in the early 1920s, after Lenin and the Bolsheviks gave Russia communism good and hard. And within the from 1917 to 1921, it's estimated that approximately 4 to 6 million citizens of the Soviet Union died, mostly from malnutrition and starvation. So that's no way to reap prosperity. The other is a satellite photo where you see two different societies, South Korea and North Korea. And South Korea, and these are both at night, of course, and South Korea is all lit up. Why? Because there are lots of capitalists providing electricity and lights and other things to South Korea. North Korea, it's dark. Why? Because it is a socialist totalitarian state in which just the little dot in where the Pyongyang, where the government lives, has some lights, but it's dark for the rest of the country. So socialism brings darkness. The free market brings light. As Mises says, what is called a planned economy is merely groping about in the dark. And even if the state attempts to centrally plan regulation by mandates or regulations, so in other words, they don't go whole hog with socialism, to the extent that they push regulation and mandates, that effectively neutralizes a functioning price system, and so it still leaves us relatively... impoverished. Now, let's suppose that we don't want to go to central planning. How else could we promote and try to achieve economic progress? Well, we could do it through foreign aid. This is economist Jeffrey Sachs, who recently has written some good things about the war in Ukraine and America's provocation of that event. But before that, he wrote this book, The End of Poverty, probably, 15, 20 years ago now. Very excited he was to get a foreword by Bono of U2, not to be confused with Sonny Bono, who was married to Cher. Those are two different people completely. But Jeffrey Sachs, in this book, The End of Poverty, basically argued that foreign aid was necessary because of the so-called poverty trap. And the poverty trap is a trap that less developed countries are ensnared in because they are in a vicious cycle of poverty. The idea is there are societies that are so poor, all of their income is necessary to be spent on consumption. Just to stay alive, you have to consume all of your income. Well, if you have to spend all of your income on consumption, you don't have any savings. And so if you don't have any savings, you have no investment in capital. And depreciation of capital goods continues, population growth, if it continues, and the result then is we have a low income, which breeds low savings, low investment, low productivity, and that keeps us in low income. And the result is a fall in per capita capital and a fall in per capita income, and that leads to further impoverishment, so people are just stuck in this vicious cycle of poverty. And therefore, the claim is we need foreign aid to get us out of this trap. Foreign aid, then, is seen as a necessary source of foreign capital. Foreign aid will help us jumpstart the process of capital accumulation, it is argued, by allowing less developed countries to overcome the savings gap. If foreign aid is substantial enough and lasts long enough, it is argued, the capital stock will rise enough to lift households above subsistence and out of the poverty trap so that then maybe they can start saving on their own. And development is further made possible if we can channel foreign aid into education in an effort to boost so-called human capital. So that's the main claim for trying to achieve prosperity through foreign aid, as sort of as a way to get some foreign capital. Well, economics has a lot to say about all of these efforts to try to achieve prosperity by the state. We could provide a critique of foreign aid just as we provided a critique of central planning. The first thing we need to know is foreign aid, in fact, is not actually necessary for development. Many less developed countries advanced rapidly before the invention of foreign aid. I mean, there was economic prosperity. This chart shows that there's significant prosperity that occurs after 1800 in all of these different regions of the country, or of the world, before 1848, which is sort of the origination of significant foreign aid in the globe. And so there can be significant, and there has been significant increases in economic prosperity without foreign aid. So foreign aid is not absolutely necessary. Why? Because foreign capital can be secured without foreign aid, right? Since 1990, for example, foreign investment has far outstripped foreign aid. There was a dip in foreign investment right around the COVID government lockdown period, but since then, foreign investment is again picking up. And so it is possible for development to occur without foreign aid. Foreign aid is not necessary for development. Additionally, we could say that foreign aid is unhelpful in promoting long-term development. Foreign aid does not encourage the development of the market division of labor. Foreign aid enables, or distorts, I should say, the natural division of labor by facilitating the direction of resources to activities where the opportunity cost of production is necessarily higher than it would have otherwise been. Investment decisions under foreign aid are not made by entrepreneurs, but the state. And the state bureaucrats have little stake in the actual financial success of the prospects, because they're not burdened by having to earn a profit. When I worked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, one of the most popular uttered phrases I heard was, "That's okay, we don't have to make a profit." Right? And the second was likened to it, good enough for government work. And so that's kind of the general approach, right, that government bureaucrats take. And the same is true in the development community. The actions of many less developed country government recipients demonstrate that they do not care too much about economic development for their own people. The same people that want to take money from more productive countries often restrict foreign direct investment. They often will take money and then pass that money on to their friends in other countries, right? So the money is, they're just sort of a pass-through. And so a lot of the money gets spent by the World Bank, by the United States aid organizations, by the IMF, and it doesn't go where it is supposed to go. One of the main problems, of course, is it's going from a government agency or the government itself to another government. Not to people who have an interest in actually engaging in productive activity. Foreign aid hinders the development of personal, social, and political characteristics necessary for development. Foreign aid increases the amount of resources and the power of the state compared with the rest of society. And that promotes the politicization of all of life. So more and more resources or get poured into how can we get another grant from another aid agency, and fewer resources are poured into actually producing goods that people actually want. And finally, it enables the state to pursue policies which would retard growth and increase poverty. You think of Mugabe, the dictator in Zimbabwe, right, who received significant amounts of foreign aid and then at the same time took a productive land, drove farmers off that land, and he gave it to his cronies. Gave it to his cronies, and what did they do? I don't have the satellite photo here, but within just like 10 years' time, significant parts of Zimbabwean farmland went from green to brown. Right, and that's not because somehow they started growing some great new prosperous brown fruit. It's not what was going on there. They drove it into the ground. A lot of these projects, another example of a project that flushed water or money down the drain, was a water project, for instance, in Africa, the Lesotho Highlands Water Project, which was funded by the World Bank, the European Investment Bank, the African Development Bank, to the tune of $3.5 billion. It was a project, began in 1986, to divert fresh water from the mountains of Lesotho to generate electricity that they would sell in South Africa. And it wasn't undertaken using profit and loss calculation, and so surprise, surprise, the electricity generated proved too expensive for most people. So they couldn't, that the people would not buy the electricity. And the water diversion, of course, created a significant amount of environmental and economic havoc downstream. And so it was, instead of the win-win sort of result that we get with a free market, it's a lose-lose. It's a lose-lose win, right? So it's a loss for Lesotho and a loss for the people that can't afford the electricity, a loss for the people who were taxed to fund this thing. It was great for the bureaucrat, right? It was great for the state. You can find more evidence for the failure of foreign aid to generate prosperity. In this excellent article by William Easterly, Can Foreign Aid Buy Growth? The short answer is no, it cannot buy growth. This is a chart I took directly from a slide presentation from Easterly, and he shows how the red line shows a GDP per capita that should have happened in Zambia if aid for investment growth had worked. In other words, if every dollar for foreign aid going to Zambia would have went to investment, and then if that investment would in turn have led to increases in prosperity at the rate at which they were getting federal aid. It should have been, quite a good rate of growth from 1960 to 1992. And in fact, the blue line shows what actually happened. They did get all this aid. None of it generated growth for the reasons that I already mentioned. And so what matters is not so much the volume of spending per se, a la Keynes. What matters is the institutions of the market, private property rights, sound money, facilitating entrepreneurship, capital accumulation, the market division of labor, and technological advance. Thank you.